Two things. Firstly, being a rather modest and, one might say, subtle sort of person, whether the two combine is another matter, I'm not here to blatantly promote my book, The Supreme Federalist Sir John Downer, and this rather remarkable production, which Wakefield Press will, because I think that really would be a bit of an offence to all of you if you felt that this was all it was about, just a bit of a promo for the book. I'm actually going to range more widely beyond Sir John and the book about him, although definitely I'll be talking about him, and probably spending a bit more time on his great rival and adversary, Charles Cameron Kingston, because the juxtaposition, the interaction between these two, I find absolutely fascinating part of Australian political history, and that's really where I'm going to focus. And in so doing, in dealing with not just their political lives, please don't expect a deep analysis of respective policy positions and so on. I don't intend to tire you with that this evening. I'm going to concentrate on aspects such as character, which is quite interesting in comparing and contrasting these two eminent political figures. And in doing that, delve into some recent research, some rather startling research on this front, with a couple of images that I warn you in advance may shock. We'll see. Perhaps you're unshockable. The second opening disclaimer I'd make is that my first slide doesn't work. I'm hoping that all those subsequently will, but we'll see as the talk progresses. If not, I'll try and be even more colourful in my use of language than usual. As it happens, and ironically, the first slide, in fact, is the portrait of Sir John Downer that you see on this splendid book. Now, again, you might think this is a very cunning idea. He's able to display the book and wave it around in front of us because he hasn't got his slide. But this was what was going up here. And the interesting thing about it is that here begins the first contrast. Let me say, incidentally, that this is pretty topical. Downer has certainly been the subject of press comment and renewed interest, of course quite remarkable interest through the publication of the biography, but also focus on his dynasty, as Anne has mentioned. His grandson, remember, very recently retired from politics, a long-serving foreign minister of Australia, opposition leader at the federal level. His grandfather was born in 1843, is still a major public figure. His father, in turn, the son of Sir John, born in 1910, Sir Alexander Downer, was also a significant political and public figure, both as a minister in the government of Sir Robert Menzies. Minister of Immigration was one of the portfolios he held for some time, and as Australia's High Commissioner for London, again an extended period of time which he served with considerable distinction. I guess part of the fallout of that was that young Alexander spent some time there as well with his father, and that's where he gets that accent that Paul Keating and others like to talk about. We don't hold that against him. And incidentally, he launched this book and we had a pleasant interchange on subjects such as that. Sir Alec had an eminent career. I mean, he was a graduate of Oxford University. He was also imprisoned for the duration of the war in Changi, emerged to become one of the post-war group of Menzies' dominant politicians from 1949, and as I say, went on to become High Commissioner. So we're talking about a dynasty here, which is, you know, a pretty remarkable thing. Kingston is also been in the news. A couple of events recently, one I'm going to be referring to, the exhumation of Charles Cameron Kingston, an extraordinary event, and you'll hear a little more about that, and the moving of his statue from its place in Victoria Square, overlooking his electorate of West Adelaide that never deserted him throughout a lifetime in politics, state and federal. He died still a member of the federal parliament, uncontested in his last election because of the respect that was accorded him, despite being extremely ill. And there his statue stands, looking rather fondly at these constituents that returned him year after year. Unfortunately, probably there was a lack of consultation with historians, in the renovation of the square and the reintroduction of the tram line, Charlie has been moved across to the other side and now stares far less benevolently at those on the eastern side who voted constantly against him and his government. A very cruel thing to do to Charles. Crueler, I would suggest, even than the exhumation that I will discuss. Be that as it may, Sir John, notice how modern he looks. He looks modern in large part because he's clean-shaven. Remarkably few of the leading men of that era were clean-shaven. Edmund Barton, his very close friend and associate in the federal movement, was similarly clean-shaven, interestingly enough. But there were very few of them. But, of course, in this era, it gives him a much more modern look than his rival, Charles Cameron Kingston, who looks very much the Victorian gentleman as he sits in his chair with his buttonhole, his topper on the table and his cane, and his beard. Interesting, of course, because this is one of the paradoxes of the Kingston-Downer relationship, that Sir John in many ways was far from modern. Kingston prided himself on his ability to dress informally, to engage with the working men in sport and other activities, whereas Sir John had a rather patrician reputation and outlook. In every cartoon you will see Sir John, there's usually a top hat and there's also a cigar hanging around somewhere. That's the difference of image, and yet if one just saw the portraits of these two men today, you'd probably misplace even the era in which they were living. Well, let's move to these two subjects of what I would suggest is current interest. They were two great adversaries stalking each other through three decades of political life in South Australia, one of the most exciting and extraordinary periods of Australian history, the transition in South Australia's case from colony to state. But one theme drew them together. On one issue, despite many political differences, they worked together very closely indeed. This was the great issue of federation, and it's the basis of their claims, and sound claims, to be statesmen. Indeed, just not statesmen at the national sense, but international statesmen at that. This is a cartoon which is called The Farewell. It's Sir John, clad in somewhat more lurid garb than the picture we just showed you a moment ago, farewelling Charles Cameron Kingston in 1897. He's on his way to the Queen's 60th year Jubilee in London, a conference called together of all the premiers of all the colonies of the British Empire, all the self-governing colonies and the princes of India and others gathered together in London at a very significant time of constitution making in Australia. Interestingly enough, Downer himself had been just to just such an event exactly 10 years before. Indeed, it was the first of these major intercolonial imperial gatherings, again celebrating a Queen's anniversary, this time Queen Victoria's 50th, 50 years on the throne. And therefore, it's not surprising that the two are joined together, each clad in the gear that might be appropriate for a royal durbar or whatever. Sir John, indeed, fondly farewelling Kingston, whose bag here has the word honours stamped on it, because it's expected that he's going to go and receive a knighthood or something, which in fact he didn't. I'll mention that in a minute. Well, he was offered it, but refused it. While Sir John has behind his back a speech and a vote of no confidence that he's intending to move in Kingston's absence, in the fond hope that this might be a way of displacing a man who seemed totally entrenched by this stage. So indeed, their international activities didn't just revolve around those two conferences. In 1900, Kingston was again back in London with Barton and Deakin, arguing for the unencumbered passing of the Constitution Bill of Australia, quite successfully, in an amazing piece of of strong negotiation in favour of a document that had been drawn up by Kingston and his colleagues, including Downer, and voted affirmatively by the people of Australia. In 1911, Sir John himself returned to London for yet another imperial event. This was the coronation of George V. And he had carried this international reputation. Like Kingston in 1900, he was invited to speak at banquets, dinners, associations, functions, and it was an extraordinarily busy time. Indeed, one dramatic event, and I thought I'd share you this as a sort of flavour of Downer as well as these events. He was present at an extraordinary banquet which had been at which all the leading citizens and others were present. At this time in Britain, 1911, there was a major constitutional crisis involving the House of Lords and conflict with the Liberal government. One of the things that had been talked about as a means of resolving it was the referendum, using a referendum process, which the government of Asquith had completely rejected as being unpatriotic, un-British and not appropriate. Downer, on the other hand, coming from the background of Australia, where the referendum had been used in a number of instances, not least, of course, in the creating of Australia by the adoption of the Constitution, rather mildly suggested that perhaps this was something that could be pursued. So he's speaking at this dinner, which is hosted by Lord Carrington, the Liberal, one of the Liberal governments. He's in the chair, and they've got George Reid and various other functionaries and other British ministers present. And I'll quote from the book here. Downer's turn to speak arrived, and after the usual courtesies, he remarked that the Australian experience had provided a lesson in the referendum which, as he dramatically put it, might well make the welkin ring in England if it was only backed up. At this point, Carrington, the chairman, interjected sharply that we cannot have politics here in any circumstances. This is a non-political meeting. No politics will be introduced while I am in the chair. The impressive silence which followed indicated the sympathy of the meeting was with Sir John Downer. Sir John replied, I thought that as this was an Australian gathering, I might refer to a Commonwealth incident which an immense majority of Australians regarded as great. This was greeted with cheers. I apologise for unintentionally offending. I'm sorry I've done so, and still more sorry that you called on me to speak. And with that he sat down and refused to speak further. Well, you can imagine the incident was taken up, particularly by the conservative press, and the tabloids went mad, you know, Dominion statesmen insulted and various other controversies. So as late as 1911, there was Downer at this international figure. And that's why Kingston, by this time, he died in 1908, of course, was no longer alive. But both of these men, to the end of their days, had a reputation that went beyond the boundaries of Australia. All right, what were their credentials in the federal movement? In Sir John's case, he'd been a participant in the first major international conference on federation in 1883, which led to the establishment of the Australasian Federal Council. He attended the Imperial Conference, I've already mentioned. He'd been with Kingston, a member of the influential South Australian delegations to both the 1891 and 97-98 Australasian Federal Convention, and in the latter, and this is where his most significant contribution lay, he drew up the constitution that was submitted conventions. He was a member of the three-person drafting committee that actually drafted the nitty-gritty, the nuts and bolts of the constitution, with Edmund Barton and Richard O'Connor, both of the latter ending up as not only federal ministers, but in Barton's case, Prime Minister, and ultimately judges on the High Court of Australia. So a very significant role at that crucial conference. Kingston as well had a long and distinguished record on federation. In 1888, he and Thomas Playford had initiated a major intercolonial conference on what was called the Chinese question, the question of immigration and other federal issues. In 1891, he in fact did a major draft of the Constitution ahead of the convention, which was circulated and used as part of the process of drafting aboard the famous Queensland steamship Lucinda as it sailed around the Hawkesbury. And incidentally, Sir John was aboard that vessel in the early stages of the process of drafting that took place over that Easter in 1891. From 1893 onwards, Kingston constantly represented South Australia at Premier's conferences. He established the procedure in 1895, which led to the second convention and revived Federation. He was president of the 1897-98 convention, a key member of the delegation I mentioned in 1900, which negotiated the passage of the bill through. So both of these men had a significant role, and their hand is on a number of clauses and provisions of the Constitution. By 1901, Kingston was in the House of Representatives and a member of the First Ministry under Edmund Barton, while Downer, who was a close friend and confidant of Prime Minister Barton, was a senator. Both were in the prime of their political careers and looked forward to seeing their commitment to Federation rewarded. In both cases, unfortunately, in a number of respects, their expectations were dashed. And I'll come back to that in a minute. But let me go to these two men I'm talking about. Just as I was suggesting that the appearances of Downer and Kingston could suggest a different political perspective than that which they actually carried out, so indeed were their origins and background. I mean, interestingly enough, Downer, the conservative, came from quite modest origins. He was the son of Henry Downer, a tailor, who'd arrived with his family in 1838. He was the fifth child in the family. He was born in South Australia, like Kingston. He was native-born in Australia, and that distinguished him, particularly in those early conventions, from many of his colleagues who were born overseas, mostly in the United Kingdom. So Downer was born here. He was born in a very difficult time in South Australia. Things had started well, and then, as we know, the crash of 1840. By this time, Henry had abandoned his tailoring business. He'd tried to operate an importing and wholesale grocery partnership. He went to the gold rush with his sons. He tried his hand at a hotel licensing. One of the hotels he managed was the Blenheim in Hindley Street. It's now the Tattersalls. It's still in the same place. It was just up the road from his tailor's shop where the Downer family initially lived and where he established himself. And he retired when his wife became ill, who died while John was still at school doing his final examinations. She died in 1861, Henry died in 1870, but a disappointed and impoverished man. What, of course, made the Downer family was the innate ability of John and his brothers, particularly in the field of law. John was an outstanding scholar and did extremely well at school and won scholarships that enabled him to go to St. Peter's College. Public examinations had been introduced for the first time in Adelaide under the patronage of the governor in 1860, and Downer, in fact, sat those examinations, gaining first-class honours in two successive years. He was clearly the outstanding scholar in the state at that time, although somewhat to the disappointment of the examiners. In each of the years, Downer sat successfully for the first-class honours. No other qualified candidate for first class could be found. And eventually these examinations were set aside, the annual examination, and replaced many years later. So Downer had made his own way, and his entry into the law and the qualifications he carried were all of his own doing, not through some silver spoon in the mouth, interestingly enough. Charles Kingston, on the other hand, was really born to the purple in terms of the Adelaide establishment. Son of one of the great founders of the colony, Sir George Strickland Kingston, who any historians, you know, contest, grapples with light over credit of the actual laying out and surveying of Adelaide. And Kingston Senior's hands on many things as well. A politician for many years, a sturdy Democrat in his approaches, a Speaker of the House, and he died while still holding that office 1880. Sir George was an eminent Adelaide citizen. Charles was the son of the second marriage of Sir George to a rather exotic partner, Ludovine Caterina da Silva Cameron. She was the mother of, her father was a respected military man, Colonel Cameron, a Scot resident in Tasmania, and her mother was the daughter of a Portuguese nobleman. They'd met during the course of the Peninsular War, and Cameron had married her then. So Charles had this this rather exotic, if you like, background in his heritage. His mother died, in fact, when he was only 2 years old, and he was brought up by a nurse. He had an older brother who he was extremely close to, and some older sisters who he wasn't quite so close to. Some of Charles' character and some of the things I'll mention a little later may well be traced to that early family situation and the way in which the boys, if you like, dominated the nurse in charge of them rather than being under the tutelage of their mother, while Sir George got on with his extraordinarily busy life in public affairs and in his profession. There's the two. And again, King Charles Kingston, 7 years younger than John Downer, had a brilliant education. He didn't go to St. Peter's. He went to J.L. Young's Adelaide Educational Institution, which at that stage was a very solid rival in terms of scholarship, although with somewhat different aims. And Kingston, again, was ducks of the school in his final year. Very much more than Downer, a sportsman. He was into football and cricket and things of that kind. Downer was was a very keen horseman, but for much of his life he had no interest in nor attachment to sports, and you'll find some interesting references to that if you look at the book. Well, both of them went into the law, and as it happened, it had become by then a kind of Downer family tradition, because his three older brothers had all entered the law, and to greater or lesser extents had extremely successful careers. There were no funds to allow him to follow up his success in the public examinations by travelling to Britain or doing some of the other things that some of those leading scholars were doing. So he did his articles in South Australia. He was locally trained, but very quickly he became a leader of the bar. His academic standing was acknowledged. He was the editor of the South Australian Law Reports for the first 10 years of their existence. By the 1870s, was clearly one of the leading barristers in the colony, despite his youth. He specialised in barrister work. Early he went into partnership with his third brother, George. George was a hugely successful solicitor and businessman, an investor, chairman of various banks and mining concerns and so on. The money of the Downers, in fact, largely came, the family wealth, if you like, from George, who never married, but distributed his largesse among his brothers and sisters and their family, without which some of them would have found the going fairly hard. So George was a very successful solicitor, and he and Sir John had a partnership that lasted until Sir John's death, and he died only a few months before his older brother. In contrast, with Sir John's rather seamless entry into the law and its practice and eminence at the bar, Kingston had a fairly rocky start. His ability was certainly recognised. He took articles in Samuel Way's office, a very good place to be, made his name as a conveyancing solicitor. But on his admission, which was 4 years after Downer's, when the formal invitation for anyone who had reason to oppose the admission was uttered, usually to be met with silence, it certainly was in Sir John's case, no objections whatsoever, an objection was indeed raised on the grounds that Kingston was not a fit and proper person due to his immoral behaviour. The objector was the brother of a wronged woman, his sister, Lucy McCarthy, who claimed had been seduced by Kingston and was living in sin with him. and therefore that made Kingston ineligible to be admitted to the noble profession. The Chief Justice, it was actually Kingston's former principal, Sam Way, overruled this objection. He felt that it wouldn't be a major impediment to Kingston's ability as a lawyer. And to be fair, Kingston soon afterwards did the right thing, as they say, and married Lucy. And that that marriage lasted for the rest of his life. But after that somewhat rocky start, he went into partnership with his older brother, Pat, but that ended up disastrously. Pat was an alcoholic, and after drinking heavily on one occasion, fired a pistol shot through a cabbie's hat and was convicted of dangerous driving down near the post office just off Victoria Square. He was convicted of dangerous firing of a weapon and given a jail term. The partnership dissolved. Pat's problems resulted in the breakup of his marriage. He went up to Port Augusta to practice. He committed suicide in 1897, that critical year when Kingston was fully engaged with Federation and various other things. There's a lot of tragedy in the Kingston life around these issues, as opposed to Sir John's life, which was certainly not all plain sailing, but was of a very different nature indeed. So here we arrive at the end of the 1870s, with obviously two of the coming men in South Australian affairs. In Downer's case, in 1878, having taken the QC ship, not by dint of having been Attorney General or through other preferment, but simply on the basis of his ability, he decided he stood for Parliament. He was successful in the seat of Barossa, and began what became a very substantial political career. Interestingly, his motives were that he felt he was sufficiently established as a lawyer. He could maintain his practice and his ability in his profession, and he was therefore prepared to serve in Parliament. At this stage, of course, members were not paid unless they were ministers, and Downer consistently opposed payment of members, which was introduced about 10 years later, on the grounds that this would just encourage people, you know, seeking a job or adventuring to try and make some money, when in fact politics should be a noble service to the people. And it may sound quaint, but in fact I think he actually believed it. And that was the... there's Sir John about in the late 1870s, about to enter Parliament. This is Charles Cameron Kingston, about the same time. He became a member 3 years later in 1881, just after the death of his father. Both of them remained in the South Australian Parliament consistently through the rest of the decade and the 19th century, and both of them went into the Federal House eventually. Well, their rivalry was obviously going to be acute, and indeed the ins and the outs of politics were consistently explored in the course of that. I'll come back to those in a minute. Both of them became attorneys general at quite an early stage, on the opposite sides of the factional fence. Downer served under Bray, Kingston under first Colton and then Playford. Downer became Premier in his own right in the mid-1880s. Kingston didn't become Premier until 1893. But here was the first, an interesting cartoon which demonstrates the kind of factional allegiances that were operating at a time when a government in South Australia was lucky to last 18 months. Certainly a government that could succeed in staying in for a whole term of three sessions of Parliament was seen as quite remarkable as they ebbed and flowed. And here we see Sir John sweeping out the Liberals of Holder, the Liberal government of Holder and Coburn and others, which was in somewhat disarray. Interestingly enough, aided and abetted on the sidelines by Kingston and Playford, who'd agreed to support his government. This is in 1892. The government didn't last very long, because after the 1893 election, in came Kingston and out went Sir John. So the same gentlemen who were standing on the sidelines supporting him proceeded to kick him out of office. At that time, it could be confidently felt, looking at the history of South Australian politics, that Downer, as the leader of the opposition, would be back in office, at least for some period, through the rest of the decade. As it happened, he never actually achieved political office again. Kingston's government remarkably not only survived its first term, it survived, it won the 1896 election, it survived the full duration of that, it won the 1899 election, and was only brought down at the in December 1899 by some internal divisions and Kingston's resolve to confront the Legislative Council by attempting to contrive an early election. A number of his colleagues newly elected in 1899 felt that was going a bit too far. A couple of them crossed the floor and his government fell. Interestingly, the government that replaced him, that of Solomon, lasted for exactly 1 week. As soon as Parliament reconvened, with Kingston sitting on the back bench, Holder, his deputy, formed another government virtually identical to the one before. As long as Charlie was out of the way with his threats of early dissolutions, everyone was happy. The government had a solid majority. It was an extraordinary period of stability in the light of the previous 40 or so years of responsible government in South Australia. But an interesting way for a premier to fall as opposed to a government, because in a sense his government didn't. So Downer sat on the sidelines in frustration. Kingston triumphed for much of the time, but both of them, as I've already said, focused on federation. Well, I'm now going to turn to this question of reputations and character and style, which I foreshadowed we talk about. Downer had a reputation of affability. He was sharp. He was a superb barrister, a hard forensic lawyer. But he managed somehow to maintain very good relationships across the factions. Kingston had some major fights with most of his opponents and indeed some of his friends from time to time. Downer somehow managed to escape this. Thomas Playford was about the only person that could really get under Downer's guard, and the animosity between old Thomas, not Sir Thomas, he knocked back a knighthood too. Sir John incidentally took one in 1887. Between Thomas Playford and John Downer was quite intense. And yet, when you read the exchanges, it's very much Playford who's the aggressor. Sir John is very often trying to placate or modify or mollify, but just can't get through. There was something, obviously, that set Playford off about Downer, just as some of the Labor members like Price were set off by him too. They felt he was patronising or whatever. But his affability meant that he could communicate across all sectors. Incidentally, as a postscript, surprising how things persist. There we have Sir Alexander Downer, the Menzian minister, establishing his beautiful country seat, Arbury Park, and Sir Thomas Playford, the then long-serving premier, grandson of old Tom Playford, wanting to put a freeway through the hills. And surprise, surprise, the freeway seemed to go right past the very front door of Sir Alex's estate. And despite huge negotiation, attempts to reroute the road, even an offer, I understand, from Sir Alec to pay for the extra cost which Playford was saying might be incurred by this, Tom was adamant that's where the road was going to go. I'm sure that this was the echoes of an old, old feud. It's interesting how these things can persist. So there we have Downer. And during the 1890s, one reason he found it difficult to succeed politically, in 1896, the height of the election, his wife became very ill indeed, and she died soon after. And he almost retired from politics at that point. Family came first in that sense for him, and he was prepared to put aside his political ambition. He had to be induced by his electoral committee to actually put his name up for the ballot. He won, though he didn't do any campaigning. It was a very difficult time for him. He fortunately remarried later in 1899. Oddly enough, on the very day that Kingston was being defeated in the House, Sir John, who delivered a pair, of course, was away in Sydney getting married for a second time, a very successful match, and Sir Alec was the child of that marriage. So despite a son dying, two sons in fact dying in his lifetime, and a number of other of those family misfortunes, Sir John had what we would see as a very regular sort of family life. Now, what about the contrast with the firebrand Kingston? Well, it was quite stark. We mentioned his contretemps on admission. His political career nearly came crumbled into dust in 1886, just after his first term as Attorney General, when it came to public notice through a petition for divorce, and we're talking about times when these things were not lightly undertaken. A petition for divorce was issued by a certain Richard Watson, naming Kingston as co-respondent. The Watson affair, which was a vast scandal, resulted in all sorts of agitation against Kingston, did him a lot of damage. The divorce petition was not contested in the end, but he was seen as guilty as charged, and editorials were scathing. The Vigilance Association of South Australia met to debate the topic, how to free Parliament from scandalous offenders against morality. They raised a petition and presented it to Parliament. It was aimed at sins against the state and demanded that any member convicted of adultery should vacate his seat forthwith. So Kingston was in very big trouble, particularly as an election was occurring some few months later. He saved himself, and this was in fact the only occasion on which he made a public admission to any kind of wrongdoing or fault in this area, around which rumours whirled throughout his lifetime. On this occasion, he confronted it squarely, and he made this extraordinary speech to his electors, throwing himself on their mercy, and concluding that he was a sinner, but how many others had sinned, and he'd never do it again, and he'd put themselves on their judgment. It's a very interesting speech to read. It did the trick. He got up only as the second elected in the two-member constituency, but nonetheless, his career was rescued. From that moment, as I said, he made no public admissions and indeed reacted with huge ferocity to anyone who tempted to raise the common knowledge that Kingston, who didn't drink and smoke, incidentally, nonetheless was a renowned fornicator. All sorts of innuendo would sometimes be raised by his enemies. I like the interchange with Attorney General William Stock at one period, who launched a bitter and venomous attack on Kingston, and in it he made an oblique reference to scandalous rumours about his private life, including saying, "There's a green baize screen on the other side I will not pull away." Well, far from being cowed by this, Kingston launched an extraordinary attack on Stock, claiming that as an Attorney General he'd been, and I'm quoting to give you a feel of Charlie's rhetoric, "received with execration, endured with unmixed shame, ejected with unmitigated contempt, politically a poltroon, ministerially a paralytic, and an imbecile." This was said on the record in Parliament. I heard today that there were noisy scenes in Parliament House. I can assure you there is nothing like the noisy scenes that were there when Kingston and others were in action in the 19th century. And then, of course, there was the famous duel. We do recall Kingston batting on with poor old Downer, keeping wickets forever, hoping he's going to get the catch that never came. We recall the famous duel between Richard Chafee Baker and Kingston. The background of which is complex, but it ended up in them, you know, Baker calling Kingston a coward, a bully, a disgrace to the legal profession, among other things, and Kingston calling Baker false, treacherous, mendacious, utterly untrustworthy in every relationship, etc., and finally challenging him to a duel in Victoria Square and sending the pistol around. Of course, Baker didn't turn up. He sent for the police instead. And Kingston was arrested was put on a 12-month good behaviour bond, which was still hanging over his head when he became Premier a few months later. Indeed, Baker claimed that this made him ineligible to be Premier, but as he hadn't been jailed, that wasn't the case. Interestingly, his counsel in that case was Sir Josiah Simon, who became a major enemy of Kingston's, and again the object of Kingston's invective. They might as well search, he said, when they're having some dispute over the hospital, the Adelaide Hospital, they might as well search for the milk of human kindness in a glass eye as in Mr. Simon. This forensic compound of squid and skunk, a gruesome ghoul with lips reeking of mendacity and fettered with malice. Well, that's poor old Simon. Well, not poor old Simon. He could give as much well as he got. Interestingly, Simon was one of the few people that Sir John actually clashed with in the Federal Senate. By this time, Simon was an ally of Kingston again and had beaten Sir John into the fourth place on the Senate ticket, which meant he had the short term. And as free traders and protectionists, respectively, they threw the mud at each other in extraordinary invective in the Parliament. But a very rare instance for Downer, not so rare for Kingston. So, you know, Kingston had what one might call character issues. There is Sir John in connubial bliss with his second wife, Una, a little Christmas card, seated in the grounds of 46 Pennington Terrace, which is now St. Mark's College. Here's Charlie in later life with Lucy, the girl mentioned earlier, a lifelong relationship, but no children of it. And she was a rather strange woman. Indeed, on the occasion when Kingston turned down the knighthood, it was reported that she, who was over there, well, was absolutely outraged by that, and somebody said gave Charlie an extremely hard time indeed, poor fellow, because she, having been spurned by the South Australian society, really felt that the knighthood was would have been appropriate for her, but Charles thought otherwise. But they had an interesting and somewhat extraordinary relationship. She was extremely long suffering. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, as I mentioned, not only were there rumours of Kingston's scandalous private life, but there is the question of patrimony. He had no natural children, but are there, in fact, living direct descendants of Charles Cameron Kingston? And this is where we come to the forensic aspect of this. And I'll just say a few quick things about it. Adelaide's a great rumour-mongering place. Any of us who've been brought up here know that. Kingston certainly was central to it. And you can identify a number of people who were alleged to be the sons or daughters of Charles Cameron Kingston. Francis Villeneuve Smith, the renowned forensic lawyer. There's all sorts of circumstantial evidence, which I won't go into here for due to lack of time, which suggests, you know, there might have been enough truth in it, certainly, for it to run as a story of gossip around the place. Conjecture based on his appearance, personality, behaviour, and certain circumstances of the registration of his birth. Never claimed by Smith himself. Who knows? No way of really testing that. Kevin Kingston, he's a lad who was adopted by Charles and Lucy Kingston. Another tragedy. Kevin was sent to St. Peter's College. He was a brilliant scholar. He died of tuberculosis, aged 18, in 1902, a source of considerable distress to his father. Now, interestingly, in his will, Kingston referred to Kevin as my son, while Lucy referred to him as my adopted son. Why would this be? Well, as Langdon Benython said in writing to someone about this death, Kingston is most cut up. Of course, I knew that Kevin was not Mrs. Kay's son, but I did not know until now he was the child of Mrs. Watson. We're going right back to the Watson case. He was born in 1883, at a time when this alleged adulteries were taking place, and there's very strong evidence that he, in fact, was the product of that. Albert Augustine Burt Edwards, another extraordinary character of the Adelaide political and public scene, the King of the West End, claimed, sotto voce, that he was the son of Charles Cameron Kingston, and gave various circumstances in which that may well have been the case, although those researching his life closely have doubts. He's been the subject of a DNA forensic investigation, which is inconclusive at the moment, but is still proceeding. An extraordinary character, Edwards, but I won't go into his life and background. Well, there's three fairly public examples, but there are others. And now let me talk about this forensic investigation. In 2005, I got a call from a certain Malcolm Simpson, a successful travel agent and tour operator. He'd been a basketball administrator, which is when I'd known him many years before. And he knew of my knowledge and interest in Kingston. And it prompted him to ring because there was a family legend that he was a direct descendant of Kingston. And the family had decided they wanted to find some way of testing it. And the first stage, obviously, was to see if circumstantially this could be established. Now, what was the story? His grandmother, Genevieve McCreenor, was born in January 1890. Her mother, an unmarried 18-year-old working as an orderly at the Royal Adelaide Hospital. No family father's name on the birth certificate, but Genevieve was told by her mother she was the illegitimate daughter of Charles Kingston. And she paid quite a high price for that illegitimacy. Her mother later married a man who rejected her. She was fostered out and placed in an orphanage. On her own marriage, the family of her husband, Fred Gray, also disowned her and him and refused to accept her. And her two grandchildren recall, whenever Kingston's name was mentioned, they passed the statue or something, they were reminded that Charles Cameron Kingston was in the bloodline. So they decided to try and test this. And it is possible to do these things. It is not unusual for families in seeking patrimony evidence, providing you go through the proper and appropriate procedures to in fact achieve some sort of outcome. And that can include the taking of DNA from someone who's interred, providing, as I say, all the proper procedures and so on are gone through. And that's how we must look at this rather unusual event, in that indeed the exhumation did take place and DNA has been taken. And some say, well, how could this be possible, number one? Well, the answer is it happens quite frequently around Australia. And in other parts of the world. But secondly, how could it happen to such a man as Kingston? Well, of course, it wasn't based around Kingston's public persona so much as the private need of the family, if you like, to have some resolution to this part of their story. Interestingly, the controversies and publicity surrounding this event, I won't go into all the details of it, but simply, again, to reassure you that all the proper procedures were given. The approvals that were necessary were done in accordance with the Act, and no special treatment was accorded because Kingston was a famous man or certain people lobbied at all. It was done as a routine, but an extraordinary routine when you step back from it, of course, and think of who is the object of it. When this publicity came out, a number of people came forward also telling similar family stories and claiming things. Now, one of them has also considerable substance. A certain William Kaiser, born in 1895, the son of Muriel Priscilla Holt, an 18-year-old who worked as a housekeeper at the Kingston family home at Merino. It was alleged that her father was Charles Kingston of William Kaiser. She'd entered a hastily arranged marriage on becoming pregnant, with Kaiser, which proved to be most unhappy. She divorced and married a man called Beaumont, which was much more successful. It was understood that Kingston had settled money in a trust for William and his education, which is why he was able to go to the fee-paying Anglican Pulteney Grammar School, Pulteney Street School, as it was then known. And that is true and verified. He left school at the end of the first term of 1908, which coincided with Kingston's death at that time. William's son was told the money either terminated or Mr. Kaiser managed to get access to the funds for his own purpose. Be that as it may, their son Peter, born 1927, could be the grandson of Charles Cameron Kingston. Tests are taking place. I said I'd show you a couple of images. Kingston was the Kingston family had a vault. And it was thought, you know, this would be a rather grand affair with a special entrance and all these things. On the contrary, it wasn't. It's just a series of shelves, very hard to get access to. But this is, in fact, Charles Cameron Kingston in the Kingston Vault. Some of the people in there are not identified, although we've got a fair guess as to who they might be. We're looking for Kevin and couldn't find him. We think he might be in an adjoining. There might be a second part of the vault to see whether there could be some cross referencing there. But because it's a vault, the conditions are fairly dry, even in West Terrace. There, as I say, has been some successful DNA which is being analysed at the moment. This is the most extraordinary image. That's Charles Cameron Kingston for forensic investigation. A number of rather interesting conclusions have been drawn. The rumour that Kingston died of syphilis, for instance. Skeletal examination for signs that are indicators. Not that that is conclusive proof. Certainly not there. And it would support people like myself who think that is not true, that the reason for his deterioration and ill health in late life was more to do with heart congestive failure than with mental trauma or whatever, although he may have had a tumour. There'll be some detailed the findings brought down on that, but there is the great man. Not exactly as he probably imagined he would be seen in his life. So can I conclude by returning to Downer and Kingston? Neither of them flourished as expected at the federal level, although Kingston became a member of Barton's first ministry. He resigned two or three years later in dispute over the Conciliation and Arbitration Act. His health continued to deteriorate. He could well have been Prime Minister in 1904 because he was the only acceptable protectionist conservative that Labor would work with. And when Watson formed his government, he was in fact invited to join that government and had to decline. But he in fact possibly could have successfully managed a ministry as he had in South Australia through the 1890s in those circumstances. It wasn't to be. Downer, on the other hand, had very high expectations. Firstly, a possible minister. That didn't happen for various reasons, which I've outlined in the book. But probably even more poignantly, in a sense, his expectation that he would be a member of the High Court, a body that he'd fought very hard to get the legislation through. He'd had a lot to do with the drafting of the bills and its advocacy. And as one of the three draftsmen of the Constitution, he had very high hopes that he would be there. Griffith from Queensland was made Chief Justice. The Parliament reduced the number of judges from 5 to 3. It was expected there would be a Victorian and New South Welshman on, and O'Connor was chosen as a New South Welshman, and at the last minute, instead of Downer as the possibility, his best friend, Edmund Barton, then Prime Minister, decided he'd had enough of the Prime Ministership and appointed himself to the bench. Downer felt very badly let down indeed and didn't speak to Barton for some years after that. Be that as it may, even when another chance came for possible appointment, he was overlooked, and even he re-entered the House of the Legislative Council in South Australia and continued to play a political role. But that would have been the great goal of his life, and he would have served with great distinction as a true Federalist and interpreter of the Constitution. He never got the opportunity. Incidentally, at this point, talking of the first federal parliament, Hugh Whig has produced tonight this remarkable framing of cigarette cards, which commemorate, issued by the American Tobacco Company, to commemorate the Federation of Australia, 1901, of members of the first parliament. And there they all are. The various characters. Here's Sir John. Charlie Kingston is down there. You'll see Senator Playford, his bête noir. You'll see Barton. Here's Richard Chafee Baker. All of these extraordinary colonial politicians, Alfred Deakin and so on, they're all represented here. George Reid. It was an extraordinary parliament, that first parliament, as the makers of the Constitution were elected by the people to fill the first Senate and House of Representatives. That is, I've never seen that document. It's a remarkable thing. Thank you for bringing it along. People might like to look at it a little more closely in a minute. So what does one say in the end? I'm reflecting on Kingston and Downer rather like Luke chapter 15, the story of the prodigal son. You know, Downer is the elder son who stayed at home and did all the right things, and there he is lying in his quiet grave at the North Road Cemetery with his wives and other members of his family. He's commemorated in this fountain and the courtyard at St Mark's College, his old family home in Pennington Terrace. A seemly kind of commemoration.
The library will close at 8:00.
I heard this at a talk the other day. Thanks, Ray. I got the message. We're nearly there. And then we have Charlie, whose unquiet vault I've just showed you, and of course his statue, which was relocated, as I mentioned at the beginning. But interestingly, isn't it, the prodigal son is the one that probably stirs the heart and excites the populace, and all the great memorials are there surrounding us to Charles Cameron Kingston, including, one suspects, those illegitimate progeny, depending on the outcome. Charles will either be vindicated or shown to be someone who was grievously slandered by the Adelaide rumour mill, or, and it's too early to say yet, it may all be true. If it was, believe me, Charlie wouldn't mind at all. Thank you.